Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had
hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, on the board. S&P Futures up 15, NASDAQ Futures up 49. Interesting day yesterday. All days are interesting, I guess, especially lately. Yesterday we had the Dow up 500, plus S&P up 15, NASDAQ down 55. At one point the NASDAQ was down like, NASDAQ Futures were down like almost 300, 400. And came back on the close. Really, Strange stuff. And we have Professor Kevin.
Yeah, good morning.
I mean, it's kind of weird because, you know, I talk a lot about, you know, people's idea versus the market. And, you know, Carl keeps talking loudly about there's been a tone change and interest rates going up instead of down. And that, you know, there's been a tone change in the market that most investors have not essentially picked up on. And I always, you know, I try to agree with them as hard as that is. But I'm quick to say that because of my experience when I got in the business and people's mindset was exactly the opposite, that it takes forever for people's mindset to change. I mean, when I started, I'll be brief, is interest rates were, you know, 15%. And they started to come down. Yet the market didn't move at all. In my first 18 months, it was actually down another 20%. Even though the interest rates, you know, we're talking about the Dow was 1,000, so it went to 800. You know, it doesn't sound like much, down 200 points, but it was 20%. And it just took people, it had such a mindset. All I ever did for 20 years is since 1967 is essentially losing the market. And if I had to put my money in a bank, I'm making, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13%. You know, I'm a blithering idiot to have anything in the market. So even one that was fairly obviously changing, nobody, you know, would cash in a 12% CD and plunk their money in the market. I mean, it just didn't happen. I mean, you were laughed out of the world if you did that. And now we've seen it go the other way. And actually, since interest rates have been going up, the market has rallied just like back then. It's like the mirror image. So you'll see days like yesterday where somehow or another this thing has been driving the market, and I, you know, I'm trying to learn from you guys who's who in this whole AI mess. Yesterday you had, you know, your Micron's down like $80 and ADM's down a boatload. So the favorite children are dropping like a stone, yet I can just tell it from my clients or some of the people that we used to do not so much my clients. My clients are pretty bright. But some of the people I used to contract work for and do protective strategies for other places, you talk to those people and they're like, okay, what am I going to buy? Well, you don't really have to buy anything. If you don't like Micron, you could sell. Oh, no, I got to buy something. I can't. It's got to be in the market. You know, okay. So yesterday, if you wanted to be a wag, you could say, okay, sell my Micron and buy like Sherwin-Williams, like we're all going to go out and paint houses or something. I mean, that's really kind of the craziness, this whole mess, Kevin. But one of the biggest winners in the last few days has been this healthcare India area. XLV is the part of the S&P that is the healthcare stuff. It's been rocketing up. I mean, we have a whole lot of investors in there, and we've been chasing calls. I mean, that thing never moves. All of a sudden, like, you know, we're going to sell Micron, buy healthcare stocks. I mean, healthcare stocks might be a buy, but I don't quite get the connection. But yet, it's always something down and then something else is up. And there actually used to be people that were really... You ever hear something called pairs trading?
No.
There were people that were really into this, and I bet there still are. You know, we don't have any here, but people would say, okay, they really know a lot about, say, Chevron and Exxon. And, you know, the guys that are in the oil... Tommy Shanahan used to do some of this, and he was really pretty good at it. You know, Chevron is growing a little faster than Exxon because every year, if you look at Exxon, the amount of oil they sell for a long period of time, I don't know if the last couple of years because I haven't talked to them about it, their reserves didn't match the amount they sold. So they essentially were, I use the term draining a little bit, where Chevron always seemed to find new reserves that exceeded oil they sold. So, but then, you know, so Exxon at one point was always $15, I'll just say $15 over Chevron. You know, and one day, like, Chevron would rally and be $10. Well, some guys would, they really thought that the relationship should be $15, so they would buy Exxon, sell Chevron, that kind of thing. And it would work the the pair. People used to do that between IBM and Digital way back in the day. But now, boy, I don't know how you could do something like that. People sell something, they buy something totally unrelated. It's kind of crazy. I'm not saying that the healthcare is not a great buy, or Sherwin-Williams for that point, but it just seems like, and, you know, some of the stocks we have a lot of here, it's been the more you sell ADM, the more you sell Micron, the more you buy Microsoft. So if the NASDAQ average is way down, you can bet in the last month Microsoft's been would be way up. And boy, I tell you what, I'm scratching my head on this. I mean, is it delineated that much in the AI area, who's the winners and the losers type of thing?
No. What do I keep telling you about AI?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to, when you've always been the guys that said, you know, in the gold rush, the people sold blue jeans, made the money.
What I keep telling you is, first of all, you know, we can call it AI, we can call it artificial intelligence. We're a ways away from it being true intelligence. However, if you think of it in terms of we're spending a whole lot of money on computing power, and it's, you know, we got to figure out how to make it pay for itself. You know, I think that's a big concern in the market right now, and I think they're looking at some of these businesses and saying their cash flow isn't telling me that they're going to make any money off of this. So you run into some of that. And I think that if people are starting to look at financial statements and make some rational decisions about it. But in addition to that, I think the money to be made short term is all in the applications. It's the people that are taking advantage of all this excess computing power, and that they are offering actual solutions to businesses that they can use out of the box. So, you know, the clear example is, can you become better at demand planning is one example where, you know, there are some really, really, you know, there are some companies that are doing a really, really nice job trying to, you know, crunch data for other businesses and, you know, help them get really good at matching their production plans to what the demand for products is going to be. And in a really fine-tooth way, because really all you're doing with better demand planning is you're shaving a percentage here and a percentage there off of your operating costs. But if you're a pretty large manufacturer, that's a big deal. That's a lot of money. And so you're starting to run into you know, people who actually are coming up with the applications to go with it, because most businesses don't have the capability of making that happen quickly on their own. I think that's, you know, when people start looking at, you know, some of the old line businesses and saying, okay, what's going on with that? I think what you're really seeing is people who are saying, who's taking advantage of this? Who is actually using the compute capability to improve their profitability? And that's why where you're seeing the swings. That's my hypothesis for all of this.
Well, they're, as usual, yours is the...
And by the way, you're starting to see that show up in various indices. You know, ISM has been up, what, for like 6 months?
Yeah.
The Small Business Optimism Index that National Federation of Independent Businesses keeps every month is up substantially. It's not up to the 50 plus year average, but it, you know, just in June it went up 2.1 points. The index, that's a big jump. That's you know, 97.4, and that's with all these businesses still citing concerns about the cost side of their business, about finding talent and all of those kinds of things. And yet, you know, the business optimism has increased, you know, to 97.4, and the 50, I'm looking at it now, 52-year average is 98. So 97.4 ain't that far off of the 52-year average, and I don't think that we have seen that kind of optimism at least since pre-pandemic times and possibly before that. I'd have to get the whole chart, and I don't have that handy.
Yeah, I wonder how that breaks down different areas and so forth, and with the ISM and all these state. I never really got into those too much, Kevin, because they seem pretty variable, but you know, I'm sure they mean something to people.
But they're run by industry groups that really don't care about, you know, about putting the best foot forward for an administration, for an economic outlook, or anything like that. They're actually measuring what their membership is telling.
Well, who does like the Empire State and all those kinds of things? Or the Empire State Index and the Midwest Index? Are those government done or are those industry groups?
Don't know. Don't know those particular ones.
What the hell? What's the one up in the New England? It's some kind of weird name. But, you know, I'm just, I mean, you're always going to give me the direct skinny on this. I just wonder what the investment, because, you know, investors a lot of times don't know or don't care about the detail you dig into. It's just somehow, some way that, you know, Microsoft and Apple are becoming, you know, they're like buyers versus sellers of this or something. So when the microns of the world go flying down, these guys go up. So there's kind of a simple something or other between one being a pair and one not. And anyway, it's kind of interesting. I was reading some of the stuff Carlson is talking about segue about this. When exactly is Fauci going in front of Congress? Is it today or tomorrow?
Today.
It was when?
Today.
Okay. So, I mean, I was, you know, kind of reading some of the stuff Carl sent that evidently is in Fauci's notes or his notebook or something.
It was diary.
It's a diary. And I'm somewhat, I'm sort of appalled. Not sort of, I'm seriously appalled. But, you know, Kevin, there's something about, I don't know, something about leadership. It's the reason it's why I've had massive misgivings about our last several presidents. And the reason why it's not really the politics, it's the people and the ability. My first job, I'm not all that proud of it, I worked for Allied Van Lines as a agency guy that would go one of the moving and storage businesses was having some problem, they send me out there and to do some small business consulting, and that's what I wanted to do coming out of school. So I would do that, but I also was the, if ever there was a project, the Vice President, Bob Seeler, who was actually my boss, Vice President of Finance, wanted to do, he'd give me the project. You know, go sell this terminal thing, do something, figure out should we invest in this. And they were the projects he wouldn't give to anybody else. And one day, I go into a board meeting with him, and he starts reading one of my reports off, and he said something. The guy says, "Well, how do you know that's right?" And he goes, "Well, that's easy. Tom did it." I looks at him. He goes, "If he did it, it's right." And so after the meeting, I go, "Bob, for God's sake, what did you say that for?" He goes, "Because the first two times you did something, I went through every single word. I went through every, I added up every column, and after doing that twice, I trusted you. But I made sure that you were doing the job before I did." I go, "Okay then." And then when I went to the CBOE and I became chairman of the membership committee, Judy Deal was the lady at the CBO that ran membership, and she would always call me and say, "Okay, we got a few new members of the committee." Everybody's application had to be gone through by somebody and a member. Okay, that was the rule. So you had a committee and you parceled out people's applications to different people. And she'd say, "Okay, we got a couple of couple of new members, you better come up and read these first. So when the person gave the report, I knew whether or not they, A, read it, B, knew what they read. And to me, I didn't learn this on my own. Between Bob Seeler and Judy Deal, they sort of taught me what leadership is like and when what you're supposed to do. And I know as president, well, I don't know as president, because I might be, you're going to get a whole bunch of crap dumped on your desk every day. I think. And but when you get something from people, the first few times, you have to pick some of them and you have to go through them yourself and see if what you're getting is a load of crap. And I didn't vote for Obama the second time for that reason, because I think he went off and played basketball while all the detail of Obamacare was going through. And I didn't, to this day, I don't think the idea of Obamacare was a bad one. I thought the lack of attention to detail on the way through was where it fell. You needed to know before you talk about an insurance exchange, which they were trying to do. You can't let, 70 insurance companies combine the month before you're going to have the exchange, or you're not going to have an exchange, and that's what happened. And he didn't pay attention to the detail, and really was the biggest thing in his presidency. If he did, he might have got a few people from the other side of the aisle, in which case it would have been a much bigger success. Then you fast forward, to Trump and the first COVID thing. And he, obviously should have known that somewhere along the line this Fauci had a little bit of a dark past. I don't think he read any of this crap. And that was the biggest thing. And Biden followed on with the exact same thing. I don't think he knew what the hell. But you need to find out the most important stuff, and you need to read it. I mean, they said Bill Stevenson, who was he was essentially M in James Bond. He was the head of British Secret Service. They said the guy read a Victorian novel a day. I mean, to do this kind of stuff is serious work. And I don't think any of these guys have put in the work. I don't think George Bush ever really read into the detail about the invasion of Iraq. I'm not saying you have to read everything from everybody. You have to count on people, but you need the instinct to say, this is the important one today. This is one I'm going to read. And I don't see that with any of these people, do you?
You see different levels of detail, but how much behind the scenes information do we really have on any of them? So you either go and say, well, the evidence suggests otherwise, the outcomes suggest otherwise, which I think is a reasonable stance to take, or you listen to what they have to say, and you start to see whether there were any any instances that would lead you to believe that people are well informed. It's just what the details are. But it also has a lot to do, and you're going to get mad at me because you're going to think I'm apologizing for them, and I'm not, because I do think taking that deep dive into things is really important. But I don't think anybody in the Trump 1 administration, as the election unfolded, I don't think they believed they were going to win. Maybe Trump did as an optimist, but I'll give you an example. I was talking to he's a congressman now from Northern Indiana, a guy named Rudy Yockum. And I've known Rudy was finance chair and he worked for Jackie Walorski for a long time. And Walorski is the congresswoman who was killed in a car accident several years ago. And by then Rudy had gone into the private business world. And so we were chatting at a Chamber of Commerce event, and what he told me at the time, and this was right before the election, is that all of a sudden, because being involved in politics in Indiana, he knew a lot of the Pence people really well, and he said all of a sudden they're scrambling because their internal polling is telling them that they have a decent chance to win, and they hadn't spent any time from Pence's point of view, they hadn't spent any time putting together a staff to, for him to be vice president, to have a vice president staff. And he said all of a sudden they're scrambling to do that now. And I thought, well, that's interesting. That was, you know, when I said they may have more of a chance to win than you think. And I remember Maddie being really, really skeptical of that. And I said, well, that's what I'm hearing.
You know, I always thought he had a good chance to win.
I tell you that story because the reason is Trump was totally relying on people like Reince Priebus, who had been head of the RNC. When they put together their administration, it was all of the usual suspects from politics, and so when, you know, as they put it together, everybody else had their own agendas. It wasn't Trump's agenda, and so, you know, during Trump won, they did that. Plus, they were fighting this 3-year battle about, you know, the Russia collusion issue, which turned out to be not true. And so you had all of this, you know, its own special kind of turmoil. But I think that included people like Fauci, they said, here, this guy is the expert. You should do what he says. And then,
he never was.
There was something I read where he went back to Burks and said, you and Fauci, you know, you're so full of it and you ruin the economy. And it's in Fauci's diary. And Burks went back to Fauci about it, and Fauci tried to calm her down and give her the there. But you know, he always figured out who was not working in his interest, you know, according to his agenda, too late. And I know I told you this during the first administration, that he would get enamored of people, he would bring them on board, and then next thing you know, 2 months later, he's ready to camp.
Do you think his victory was a bigger victory than Clinton over Bush?
What do you mean a bigger victory?
Well, I mean, for some reason, Kevin, maybe just because of people in the financial community, I knew, me included, I knew all kinds of people that wouldn't vote for Hillary if she was the only person on the ballot. I mean, I don't think, I had a much greater appreciation of the hatred of Hillary, not hatred, but the dislike of Hillary with all the crap she did stuff going wrong accounts and things like that. I thought there was a real deep-seated dislike of her. I gave Trump a chance right from the get-go. I really didn't give, when he started out, Bush self-destructed. Clinton never expected to win. He thought it was a trial run for the next election.
Well, he may have, but the difference, I think, Tom, is that by the time we got around to the weeks before the election, I do think at that point that Clinton was probably going to win, and that's my recollection of it. And I remember.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time ago, but yeah, I mean, I'm talking about simple stuff, Kevin.
Into Election Day, I don't think there was widespread belief that that Trump was going to win. So, in that regard, Trump was a bigger upset. The difference this time around in the administration is, and it may have been, you know, from looking at it from a political opposition standpoint, it may have been the defeat in 2020 may have been the worst thing that could happen to those opposed to Trump, because he had 4 years to sit around and figure out who really he could trust, who we could bring into his administration that he believed would work together. And you're seeing it. I mean, it's a pretty cohesive administration.
It
doesn't leak like a sieve like it used to. It, you know, there's still leaks, but it's much more occasional as opposed to every day.
I'm talking about kind of the simple
there's
stuff.
There's a lot more discipline in this administration than there was.
All right, whatever. He's way better in your mind. The point being, I'm talking about 8 years ago.
What did you just say? He's way better in my mind.
I think this administration, I think he's got a bunch of goons working for him. But let's not go there. Let's stay on the phone. I'm saying, he and Biden.
Who are the goons?
Whatever.
If you're going to say it, you should defend it. Who are the goons?
ICE people, Kristi Noem, her husband, the boyfriend. Let's not go there. What I'm saying is, between him and Biden.
Well, we're going to go there sooner or later, because if you're going to make the claim that they're goons, I won't.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is, my idea of how either one of those guys, whether they're doing other stuff during the day, God only knows, when you see stuff like, okay, on one hand you got Harvard saying it's okay to be on an airline sitting next to somebody, and on the next news report, if you're across the street from somebody on a windy day, you got to put your mask. So much stuff was a disconnect, Kevin, that we really needed some leadership from someplace. That there was, and we're talking about this Fauci. For God's sake, it's one thing to have, you know, people stealing a few bucks. People have done that forever. When you start keeping things off the market that are going to help people, because, and I still can't figure out how Fauci got paid by all this. I mean, I don't know what his motivation was, other than being like a.
He had a lot of money off of drug royalties and things like that. But what was his motivation? What was his motivation? We covered this a couple of weeks ago.
No, we didn't, because until Carl started sending me stuff regarding the depth of, you know, keeping this drug off, doing this, I never knew how deeply screwed up he was. But I mean, it's not like the guy has the same amount of money as Epstein. I mean, is he that rich? I don't even know.
Well, he has generational wealth that he's accumulated, but. You know, what was really going on? Remember, we talked about why, you know, we got into Fauci a little bit. So as I was digging, the question is, why did he get a pardon that dates back to 2014? Remember that conversation we had? And that's because this is much farther reaching. The idea that COVID blew up because of mishandling the research and the research results out of a lab in Wuhan is a smaller piece of what was really going on in macro, and that was that we were funding research that they weren't supposed to be funding. It was at best it was in violation of the spirit of Obama's executive order, if not the letter of it.
Kevin, but was there ever a law? I mean, I don't know. I don't know.
No, but it doesn't matter. If your boss issues, you know, an executive order, you're probably supposed to follow it, and not find a workaround by funding the money to through a third party to do it. That's just laundering.
Where did the money originally come from?
The question is, why does it go back to 2014? And that tied us back into what happened in Ukraine in 2014. And the long-standing complaint, and a lot of that came out of Russia, but it came out of a lot of directions, is why are we running these bioweapons labs in Ukraine, and that there's a whole string of them. And, you know, Victoria Nuland, who was ambassador there, I believe, was her role. She actually admitted it along the way. So, you know, we know this was happening. Well, this is a guy who had a lot going on that was in violation of all kinds of standards, who had to cover his ass. And so, you know, and I think everybody's missing that with this stuff in the diaries, because the stuff in the diaries is very focused, you know, the reporting on it is very focused on what happened in 2020. And while that's important, there's a larger context to all of this. And so now if you have a small cadre of people who have to cover their asses so that they don't get blamed for this, they may have only lit the fuse, and maybe it got completely out of hand. But even as it got completely out of hand, nobody stepped forward. They just rode the wave of it getting completely out of hand and said, well, wherever it leads, it leads, as long as I don't get the blame for it.
Kevin, would you have, I don't see how you would, so I'm kind of jumping you here. I mean, going back to, you know, people in World War One gassing people and stuff, and people having, you know, gas masks and stuff. This bioweapon stuff, I mean, and that's chemical weapon, but it's same sort of thing. But was it ever? What do you suppose the whole history of it was? Was it ever above board? Was it ever, you know, money passed by Congress to develop or look for somebody else's bioweapons, or was it always some lurking in the background? When I ask that, I'm trying to say the money that Fauci, not personal, well, whatever, his group, that somehow funneled to Ukraine and this Wuhan lab, was that government money, or did they go get third-party money, or did the CIA run an op somewhere and sell opium and give them the money?
CIA nexus in this, yes.
They do what?
There's a CIA nexus in this, yes.
I mean, I just wonder if the whole history of this, was it always, I'll use the term, under the table? I mean, I think most people would say, well, if the Russians are doing it, like, we better do it, you know, or something along those lines. But was it ever, you know, I'm asking you this because you might know, was there ever like a bill put through Congress where we're going to put $50 million bucks together to monitor and counter anything the Russians do by a weapon? I mean, was there ever an appropriation like that, you think?
I would think yes, although it wasn't necessarily identified in any detail before Congress. So I think you have some small oversight groups that are sworn to, pinky sworn to secrecy, and so they have oversight responsibilities, and so Congress will pass CIA budget, but they will pass it in a way that allows a lot of flexibility in how the money is spent.
Well, you hear these kind of wacky rumors through the years, and you never know if there's any substance to it. I mean, when the U.S. of A, went into Afghanistan, I read something somewhere, Kevin. I don't think we were doing the show, and maybe Wayne or Lou would know, but the Taliban, as ruthless as they were in a lot of ways, it actually put most of the poppy trade out of business because they thought it was sinful or something. And then when we got in there, it sort of started to flourish again. Now, I'm just asking, is that some sort of a separate money pot for the CIA where if they don't get the dough from Congress, that's the kind of money they use for something like this? There must be a source of income. Who was on the show that was telling us that?
Yes, but if you're asking me to say I am in command of the details of that, I'm not.
Yeah, me neither. It wasn't that long ago, Kevin. Who was telling us that they ran some stuff down in Tennessee where it was a CIA front for a liquor business or something? Who the hell was telling us that? Somebody on the air.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I mean, you just wonder if anybody's really... who's in charge of all this? Is anybody? It's kind of scary, isn't it? You wonder if the enemy isn't yourself half the time.
The term deep state, but there is a deep state.
Well, is it a...
There are people in the bureaucracy. What was it? It was Schumer that said this during Trump's first term. He said, you shouldn't do anything... I don't remember if it was the CIA or the FBI, because they have seven ways to Sunday to get even with you.
Well, isn't that, everybody's convinced that that's what killed Kennedy, right?
Kennedy, McKinley, you take your pick, yeah.
Why do the Brits seem like they're straighter, more straight on this than we are? I mean, they just
not. Oh no 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 no! They're not. Absolutely not. They're not. I mean, how much have we discovered just in the last year or less? And this is the Treasury has issued sanctions against all kinds of British banks, and it's because. A whole lot of money has been laundered through the British banking system for Iran to bypass sanctions, for drug cartels. That's all in there. And we've been issuing sanctions against those banks for things that we've started. And by the way, as all this stuff was unfolding with the British banking system, who was in charge of the Bank of England, the Central Bank of England?
I don't know who.
Mark Carney, who is now the Prime Minister of Canada.
Well, the product. So I mean, we're not. If something's happening there, nobody's better at this at knowing where money goes than our Federal Reserve. So if money got to hear from Russia for roller bearings, if they wanted to, they could find out. We don't seem to want to either.
Well, they do want to, they just don't want to tell anybody, and they want to allow it. And that's sort of where I am with Carney. He knew what was going on there, but he wasn't going to discourage it because there's a lot of influence money there. I mean, just take something like Lloyd's, and how much money has Lloyd's made in just insuring providing the insurance for shipping traveling through the Strait of Hormuz. Well, you know, their rates aren't going to be nearly as high if Iran is docile, but they're not. So they, you know, they've had to insure the threat, and that's been a very profitable business for them. So we don't want, if we can fuel the sanctions, if we can, you know, bypass the sanctions and fuel dollars back to them, good. That's good for the London-based financial system. So no, there's a lot of dirty hands here throughout the world.
Well, why? I mean, we get this displaced, not displaced, but we have people here that are more than willing to talk about how dirty the British are and how Carney was involved in it, and yet we have this whole Epstein thing here, and I'm not talking about the girls. I'm talking about the massive money laundering operation that he and his gang seem to have been allowed. I see zero congressional investigation, zero executive branch investigation is to find out who all those people are in the money. It's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, because whether it's the people who would be the investigators or whether it's the constituents of the people who would be the investigators, they're a protected class.
Well, how long? Here's a question: how long do you think we can go as a supposedly an independent, free society? If that continues, I mean, people have always, there's always been nasty people, right? So you always had to deal with that. But this, it seems like it's more insidious right now that group has got kind of more power. I mean, you didn't have, in World War II, you had, you know, some guy who made hats, Harry Truman, going through every damn contract with Roosevelt's blessing and trying to find the biggest thieves. With everybody's blessing. I don't see anybody like that now. I don't see anybody that when Obama was there or when Biden was there. It's almost like it's accepted. And I don't know how far you can go with that acceptance before the rest of the people go, what the bleep? I think we're almost reaching that stage.
Well, I don't think we're getting to the core of it at the moment, but have you been following the work that J.D. Vance has been doing, leading teams of people attacking? Because the fraud that they're uncovering and the fraud that they're filing charges and prosecuting is in the hundreds of millions. It's not the billions that, and that's why I say it, to a large degree, it's trimming around the edges, but it's also a start. And I think there is some good work going, and it doesn't get reported a lot, but if you are paying attention, you can see it.
I am paying attention. They're going after people they don't like, which was just fine. I mean, I don't like a lot of the crooks as well. But
what do you mean they're going after people they don't like? For
I mean,
example?
I don't see them going after Epstein's people. I don't see them going after what's going on. And I don't see them going after.
You made a positive assertion. Don't tell me who they're not. Tell me who they are.
Okay. Well, I guess there's some problems in Medicare. I guess there's some problems in Medicaid. But it's whatever. It's always about those kinds of people. I don't see any issues with. I mean, the other day, look, we had six people in Congress. By the way, a couple of them were Democrat, four were Republican out of the six that were reported buying stock in SpaceX, and they're on the committees. Tell me that J.D. Vance or somebody doesn't come out and say, "Hey, these six people are now bouncing these committees. We'll find them another committee." There's no commitment to honor anywhere here.
There definitely is not, because we had a bill before Congress about controlling what stocks they can buy or sell or do what they can do, and of course Congress is saying, sorry, no, we're not voting for that.
But I mean, he's president of the Senate. If anybody could do it, he could.
Well, no, he can't pass a bill by himself.
No, but I'm saying he could say out of these six people, Kevin, how many were, I forget how many were senators, say half were senators, half were reps. I don't know that, but I know there were, out of the six, there were four Republicans and two Democrats, which it could just have been the other way around. But evidently all six that were named were on committees that would be in a spot to deal with SpaceX. I would like to see J.D. Vance come out and say, okay, we just did this. as long as I'm president of the Senate, which he is, I mean the vice president, I guess that's the title, right? They're either off the committees or every time something has to do with SpaceX, they're in the hallway. I'd love to see somebody say that.
I would too. I don't think it could be accomplished, but at least he could give it a shot. I would be fine with that.
I think they could move wherever they want off a committee. They're in charge, right? Republicans?
Well, they are. But now, you know, again, I go back to, you know, when I talk to you about, you know, Trump's first administration, who we could trust, who we couldn't trust. Just take this one thing, because, you know, this whole stuff about SAVE Act and voting is a big deal right now. And can they get enough Republicans on board to make it happen? Well, there are 12 states that have more registered voters than voting age citizens. 12 states that have that, which means that their voter, it could be as benign as, yeah, their voter rolls are just screwed up, and none of these extra voters that are listed vote, and everything's really just fine, we shouldn't worry about it. Or that is probably a way, the states where they're most, you know, ripe with fraud, that this is a good way, because if you can engineer a lot of that kind of voting, then you can maintain your office. Well, you know, let's just look at the states that are red states where that exists. Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, Dan Sullivan. Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul. South Dakota, John Thune, Mike Rounds. Maine, Susan Collins. Do you think any of those, if they are benefiting from the current situation in their states as far as how votes are handled and how voting is handled, do you think any of them are going to support a change? And the answer would be
well, so the number
we still have a lot, you know, this isn't it might skew one way. Some of these issues skew one way or the other, whether, you know, Democrat or Republican, but they don't skew 100% one way or the other.
Some states allow people with green cards and they're not citizens to vote in local elections. So they're gonna be on the voter rolls. It doesn't mean they can vote in the federal election.
Yeah, see, you're doing the same thing. Like I said, what you might have the most benign solution, or you might have the most, not benign. Let's just say, the.
I'm just saying if that's the truth. Next question would be how do you delineate?
These are the same people for the most part, who are just not willing to make this happen. And then you have states where, you know, I'm sorry, not giving you the voter rolls, not letting you, no examinations, the voter rolls or anything. Heck, in Wisconsin, they were under an order, and this goes back to when I lived there, they had an order to go through and clean, dead people, people who'd moved, to go clean up their voter rolls, to do an audit of it and clean it up. And in this case, it was the Democratic Party, but it didn't necessarily have to be. But it was the Democratic Party that fought it and went to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin and, you know, fought it to make sure it didn't happen. And in many cases, they're going to lose. In this case, they didn't, because, you know, they kind of own the Supreme Court there too, even though it claims to be a nonpartisan electorate. But even so, sometimes you're just there to run out the clock before the next election. And so they ignore what the law says and fight it tooth and nail. This is going on all over the place, and so, you know, you have all these subplots around things that you see in, you know, like in national news reports that you see get cursory treatment, but the subplots as you go through state by state and area by area are much, much different.
Well, you either believe somebody or you don't. And I am at the point where I don't, everybody seems to think the stuff that the amount of non-citizens actually voting is very small. Yet this guy's going to keep telling you that it's millions of people. Or was it 250,000 or something? Which seems way higher than anybody else's estimate. And, you know, last time, you know, he got the Hispanic vote. So, I mean, if they were all voting, I think they were voting for him.
He got more of the Hispanic
vote. Okay, well,
win that.
But I mean, I'm not going to believe that if he says it's a problem, it's necessarily a problem, or if it's any worse than it's ever been. I mean, what?
How many congressional elections are decided by hundreds of votes?
And every one of them is crooked, or what?
No, but on the other hand, if you want to have confidence in the result, then if something is decided by 150 votes, then you probably want to have confidence that the voter rolls are accurate, that the registered vote.
Been the same? I mean, what would you guess, being better at statistics than me, any kind of election, what do you suppose the slop is? I mean, I've been a big not proponent of mail-in ballots from day one. I mean, the idea that we figured out that maybe the more of those people vote against me, so we got to stop it. The whole idea that when you have a signature on the envelope, that it's the person, you check the signature, and then because you don't want to know how that person voted, that somehow you separate the two. From day one, I thought was crazy. I mean, and I don't have a problem with people going to the polling place and voting. If we really wanted to do this properly, which neither side does, we would do what they do in France. We would have or Europe or someplace, where we would have an election on a Saturday and a Sunday with enough polling places where everybody could get to, where you look at the person. I don't have a problem with showing an ID, whether it proves, you know, if it's a birth certificate or whatever, and that's a problem. But, I mean, your signature should... I don't have a problem with that at all. I would do that tomorrow. But nobody seems to want to do that. they all want to get it to the point where only their side gets to vote. Well, duh. I want everybody to be able to vote. But why can't we do it on a weekend, Kevin? I mean, why do we have to do it? Why is a Chicago election on, like, a snowy St. Patrick's Day, where you let all the people from the county off work for the day to go vote, and everybody else is working, struggling to get there? I mean, to me, this has been insanity on both sides forever. Why don't we just propose something that makes more sense? But now, there's no way...
I agree, but you know what kind of push... You know what pushback you're going to get for doing it on the weekend? Is the people who have to work weekends are, hospitality workers, restaurant workers, etc., that you're disproportionately affecting... The people who have to work on weekends, which tend to be on the lower end of the economy.
I have no problem with an absentee ballot for a reason, okay? And one of my
I'm just telling you what the pushback will be.
Okay, but I'm kind of going forward here, and one of the ladies I knew a long time ago, I haven't seen her in ages. She was an election official, judge for like forever. And remember, who was the guy nobody liked? He ran for... The white guy who ran for county board president—I don't know if he lost to Prinkwinkle or somebody—but he marched on the building, sort of like a small January 6th, although they didn't go inside or anything. And everybody said, "Oh, this guy's just a loser. What's he doing?" And I'm thinking, well, this lady friend of mine said that, you know, it used to be that the amount of absentee ballots were people who were in the army, who had to be out of town for work or whatever. You knew in advance, and they sent in an absentee ballot with the signature and everything. But the absentee ballot would go to the precinct, and the precinct would count them, check the signature, check the address, just like if the person showed up. And they had to be there by the time that the election was over that night. Okay, now to me, if we're talking, you know, 1% of the people, and you know they're in the damn army, I don't have a problem with that. But then she said, oh, no, this year all those ballots went to the county building, not to the precinct. And I'm going, I immediately smell a rat coming. I mean, I'm not immune to rat smelling, I don't think. I immediately smelled a rat. But now we've got this, some states are so into this in-mail-in ballot. What did I tell you guys a while back? In the last 3 years, like 3,500 precincts have closed. I don't think if you stop the mail-in ballots right now, I don't think they're manned for the other stuff, which I think is abhorrent. I would love to see a straight election. You got to show up unless you can cause why you can't on a Saturday and Sunday, and having a Republican person there or the other person there to look at you, make sure you're the right person, and do it the proper way. But we're both sides don't want any part of that. They want it only so their people could vote. I mean, duh.
Well, yeah, they don't. But you also, it's one thing to be able to request a mail-in ballot. You know, first of all, this idea that we vote, you know, for weeks or even a month before election.
Oh, that's crazy to me. That's crazy.
Is nutty.
Yeah.
But you can request a mail-in ballot, and then, you know, it's sent to you. There are other states where they just take the voter rolls and they send everybody a mail-in ballot and say, you can come vote if you want, or you can send this in. Well, now let's go back to how many states have more registered voters on the rolls than they have actual voters? That's interesting, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't... All the way up and down, I remember giving Matty Weber crap on the radio one day. Matty and his wife used to live upstairs, his lovely bride. And he's telling me, yeah, Jill dragged me to this early voting, and we're downtown at this place. He goes, it's hotter than hinges of hell. We had to go up 5 flights of steps. It took us like an hour and a half. I go, Matty, the voting place is 50 yards away. There's never anybody there. What are you doing? I mean, what is the point of all this, Kevin? I mean, I know that I'm unusual and that I can actually walk out the door and the park literally is 100 yards away. I know it's not that convenient for a lot of people because some have closed, but what would ever possess me, unless I knew I was, you know, somewhere to see a client that day or something, what would possess me to not do that? Why would I want to mail the thing in? What if the person I voted for died? And then what?
Well, I understand that. But, if you want to play with elections, that's a great place to do it.
And both sides. Whenever I hear a politician say, well, it's not important who you vote for, it's just important that you vote, I go, bullshit. If you're not voting for me, I hope you break a leg on the way to the... I mean, who's kidding who, Kevin? Right?
Yeah, and I don't think... I haven't heard that in a long time, too. But, yeah, it used to be, yes.
Everybody used to say that.
If you get to vote. No, the important thing is you get to vote for me.
Yeah, hey, we have to mention... Since we don't have, should have our guys, but maybe what do you think of this big sponsorship at the Irish?
I try not to. They're certainly not the only ones, and there are other schools with major sponsorships. And for everybody, and we can talk more about it Friday.
Yeah.
For our listeners, they announced an agreement with SoFi yesterday. And so now they're going to wear SoFi patches on their uniforms. So, there's actually a long list of schools that are doing that, some of which make sense to me and some of which don't make nearly as much sense to me. University of Memphis has FedEx. That makes sense to me. That's a local, locally based company that also... it's supporting its local its local business, but what did I call them? The Eat at Joe's people. There's things like Michigan State has the Michigan State Federal Credit Union. I doubt that that's netting them a lot of money, whereas I sort of suspect that we are talking a lot of millions of dollars.
Well, there's a big difference between being, PTI being the official brokerage firm of Notre Dame on the radio broadcast and putting somebody's thing on your helmet, for God's sake, I think. I mean, there isn't. But, I mean, one is the radio broadcast that the Irish own, pretty much. But who's got the SoFi Stadium? Is that L.A.?
Yeah, that's L.A., yeah.
What's...
Well, but I'm not sure where SoFi is based. So,
I mean, that's their they sponsor that stadium that they couldn't say during the soccer thing, right? It was Los Angeles Stadium.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to see how that contract was worded.
Yeah, and SoFi is located. Their corporate headquarters is in San Francisco.
So what's enough? Are they gonna get on the Golden Dome too?
So the only good thing about this is that SoFi is not sponsoring Southern California, at least yet, USC.
Oh God. Well, we got stuff to talk about. Do we have Russell?
One more real quickly, because Russell might know this too. So this week, Salvador Perez became the all-time leader in home runs for the career home runs for the Kansas City Royals. First of all, and this should be easy, who did he pass?
It's got to be Brett.
Yeah, I was going to say Brett.
Absolutely, it was Brett. So, yep, so now he's three. He has 318 compared to Brett's 317, and then it falls down to 197 for Mike Sweeney. But here's your real question, and you know, we'll throw this at the group here, and then I'll leave you alone. That makes him the fifth active player, currently active player, to lead a franchise in career home runs. How many of the other four can you name?
The guy in Cleveland does, doesn't he? Is he believing that?
Nope.
Then you got me kind of stuck. Mike Trout, Angels maybe?
Mike Trout is one, yes. Mike Trout is the all-time leader for the Angels.
I don't know. Russell? Got a thought?
I have no thought.
Okay. There's one more.
I didn't even know the All-Star game was last week.
Oh, okay. Well, one of the four is playing for the team he leads. Two of the four. Mike Trout is one. Manny Machado is the other. He is the all-time leader for home runs for the Padres.
Okay.
The other two are not playing for the team they lead. One is Pete Alonso, is the all-time leader for the Mets, and he's playing in Baltimore now. And the other one would be really hard to get. That's Giancarlo Stanton, who is the all-time home runs leader for Miami, for the Miami Marlins, even though he's been playing for the Yankees for God knows how long.
I've been holding on to this one for a while, and I keep forgetting. Russell can help with this one as well. I'm just going to come up in a second. What Major League Baseball teams actually have Hall of Fame players for every position?
They're doing what?
Ding, ding, ding.
They've got to be the Yankees, right? Really?
Yep.
Cardinals.
Well, we'll definitely go Cubs as Chicago homers.
Yep.
Okay.
Only two more.
Dodgers.
And what's the position that's holding all of them out?
Not a lot of catchers in the Hall of Fame?
No, close. There's only 10 first basemen, third basemen?
I was going to say third baseman, yeah.
Well, the teams are the Cubs, the Pirates, and the Red Sox.
Interesting.
And one of them is a cheesy one. The Cubs are absolutely there. They got Gabby Hartnett, the first base Frank Chance, second base Sandberg, shortstop either Banks or Tinker, or you could have him at first base, third base Sano, left field Williams, center field Heck Wilson, right field Andre Dawson or Kiki Kyler, and pitcher Fergie Jenkins. Red Sox, they're all the way down the line too. They got Carlton Fisk. Their third baseman would be who do they got for third base? White Box and Ted Williams, Tris Speaker. I don't know if Tris Speaker was on those guys. Right field Harry Hooper, pitcher Pedro Martinez. Now here's the Pirates are sneaky here though. They had a deeper dive into baseball history to fill the catcher position. The catcher, Pittsburgh relies on a unique historical technicality. Connie Mack and Al Lopez both played catcher for the Pirates before he got into legendary Hall of Fame managerial careers.
Yeah, okay.
And they also alternatively, because Major League Baseball officially integrated the Negro Leagues in the Major League records in 2020, Pittsburgh baseball history now includes the legendary Homestead Grays, which means Jazz Gibson is in there as well.
That's a huge stretch.
That's a stretch. But Al Lopez...
I'm going to take a left on you guys real quick. You know, I went to Memphis.
I know you did.
Yeah.
And I just to give you an example of how terrible things have turned for college sports, when Calipari was coach, one of his last seasons, which would have been less than 20 years ago, he wanted, because FedEx had done so much for the university, he wanted to have a night, you know, a FedEx appreciation night where the team actually wore uniforms that were FedEx colors instead of school colors. And then they were going to auction those uniforms off for charity and all this other kind of crap. And people had such a fit that they ended up canceling it.
That's interesting.
And well, now they got a FedEx. And also, there was one year that the CEO of FedEx donated a nice chunk of money to Memphis, and his son just turned out to be the starting quarterback on like a 2-10 team.
Kevin, what was the I was down there BSing with you in the Convocation Center. This was you know, it was a while ago, but it wasn't forever ago. Wasn't the hockey team or somebody in the national playoffs, and it wasn't on TV? Somehow or another, they had a showing of it at the Convocation Center, and the a lot of the guys on the football team, you couldn't comp, you know, they comped in a bunch of students. You couldn't comp them in for the $15 because that would be illegal.
I had a friend that was on the golf team. He couldn't work a part time job. It was just silly.
We don't worry about that anymore. You know,
I had a conversation, actually. It was an interesting conversation because it gave me some insight into how well educated some of these families can be when it comes to what's legal and what's not. You go back to the days when, you know, Pat Connaughton was playing basketball at Notre Dame, which is a long time ago because he's had like a 12-year NBA career.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it seems like yesterday, but it wasn't.
Yeah, it does seem like yesterday, but it wasn't. But yeah, I got to know his family a little bit for, you know, through different channels, and so there was a game watch planned on the in the hockey arena on the big screen for the football bowl game, whatever game it was, and so I was talking to Sue Connaughton, who's Pat's mom, and saying, you know, after the game you play that afternoon, you should the team should be able to go over and just, you know, get comp to go into the event. It's, you know, it's kind of an alumni club event, but it's open to anybody. And she says, oh no, can't pay, can't do that, impermissible benefit. They could pay their way in, but they couldn't just get comp in there. So it is kind of interesting as to what they are allowed to do and what they aren't. Just real quickly, and then I'll leave you guys alone. So Notre Dame got SoFi. This makes sense. The Air Force Academy and the Army, West Point, both have USAA.
There you go.
That makes sense to me. The other one that makes a lot of sense to me is, who do you suppose the sponsor is for the University of Wisconsin that gets a patch on the uniform?
Kraft or somebody.
Line and Kugels.
Line and Kugels would be good, but they're probably not going to do beer.
Damn. That'd be perfect.
Welcome to Delicious, folks. Culver's is their sponsor.
Yeah, really? That makes sense.
An awful lot of people.
Now, when they show up in blue Culver's uniforms, I'm done.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
Kevin, hang for 1 second. I have a theoretical question to ask our cerebral graduate professor. People, you know, are ragging totally on this NIL stuff, but I guess I'll ask the question: explosion that's headed for the schools, how could it be any other way? Do people actually think that schools could make gazillions of dollars on this for the next 50 years and the guys get paid nothing? I mean, could there possibly be another?
You come from a school that makes money off of sports. And when you go through the 134, Division I college, or whatever they call them now, college football programs, maybe a couple of dozen actually make money. And that's before paying all these guys.
Do you think with the...
I mean, that's why we're, you know, basically going to ruin Notre Dame uniforms from here on out by slapping the advertisements on them.
Russell, do you think that any team, and I'll make the bifurcation here, any team that's in one of these conferences with these big TV money that every single team gets, even if you're crummy... Do you think any of them
that's
are...
True. Yeah, you just, that's two conferences. That's it.
They all do. ACC's...
No, it is.
Well, you got the Big Ten, the ACC, the SEC, and who's the other
ACC guy? Contract is horrible.
It is, okay.
The SEC and the Big Ten contracts are more than twice everybody else's. There's really three levels in college football now. There's the Big Ten and the SEC, then there's the ACC and the Big 12, and then there's all the other schleppy schools.
Okay.
That really the SEC and the Big Ten have really kind of.
All right, final.
And I think it's always to a certain extent been like that, but it's widening out. That's why all the top teams from the ACC and the Big 12, are bending over backwards to try to get to those other two conferences.
Okay. Well, next last question for Kevin: When do you think? And I'm going to say when, not if. When do you think it's going to be either so ridiculous or unsafe for the top conference to actually play the bottom conference?
It already is.
I mean, but they still do it. When are they going to stop doing it?
Well, they're never going to stop doing it because they get an extra home game out of it.
Well, but I'm saying, when are common sense people going to come and say the Alabama team or the Notre Dame team with a $50 million payroll is not going to go beat up on Northern Illinois? I mean, when are, even though they lost them? I mean,
when Northern Illinois says we're not going to let ourselves get beat up on, they ain't worth the money.
Okay. It's not going to be imposed by somebody with common sense on top, is what you're saying.
I don't think there's any. The problem is there's nobody with common sense on top. Therefore, you've got the kid from Vanderbilt who graduated at 26 who kept suing for another year to play college football.
Well, I mean,
that we've got a bunch of 24 and 25 year olds playing college football now because the eligibility rules don't mean jack, because all you got to do is file a lawsuit and then a judge, you want to be the starting quarterback at Alabama, even though you're 27 years old and on your second marriage with your cousin, and the NCAA says no, and then a lawyer files a case in Birmingham, and the Birmingham lawyer, who is wearing nothing but Alabama crap under the robe, goes, "Oh yeah, he gets another year. He deserves that."
Well,
because there's no. It's because there's no central. My academic office is across the street from the NCAA headquarters.
Really?
And I almost want to walk over there sometime and just go, what are you guys doing in here?
What the hell is the question?
Well, I mean,
I have a question for Larissa. Whose patch is going to go on the Purdue uniforms?
I have no idea.
If you ask my daughter, she would say clandestine services of the United States government.
There you go.
All the students there are convinced. All the students in STEM there are convinced that everything they are doing is to create weapons.
I have a question for Larissa.
I vote for the XXX Family Restaurant.
That would be perfect.
Here's a marketing question. I got a marketing question for Larissa because she probably knows this more than us. What is the marginal value of the 100th marketing sticker that goes on the behind of a NASCAR racer?
I can confidently say I have no idea what the marginal value is.
I often wondered that, because they got, 50 or 60 of them on their uniforms, right? I mean, what would possess you to pay to be the 61st patch on a guy's uniform? Yet people do. That's startling. Let me go with a real quick story here. My uncle.
I'm going to drop off. I'll listen to this.
All right, Kevin, you've heard this one before. Larissa probably has not. My uncle played 12 years of professional football, back during the Depression. I mean, he'd be 100 and something now. But he was a guy that worked all day, and then he went to football practice. It was something like people who play rugby in, other countries. And they would scrimmage. This is back when the NFL was a fledgling league. And he was on a team called, the West Side All-Stars or something. They'd go somewhere for the weekend. They'd come back on the train and, he probably got $50 a game or something. Well, they would scrimmage the Bears once in a while. So they're playing at, Eckersall Stadium, one of these stadiums all the high schools are in now. So they're actually beating the Bears at halftime. My uncle's, he's 5'10 and a half, 190 pounds, a dude you would not mess with, strong as an axe. And he was a really good football player. Well, they're playing against the Bears, and all of a sudden, Halas threatens to fine the team $50 a man if they don't win by 2 touchdowns. But then he puts Nagurski in the game. Well, Nagurski runs with the ball. My uncle and 3 other guys bounce off him like he's a steel girder. And he carried the ball 3 times, scored 3 touchdowns, and the Bears, you know, basically kicked their ass. Well, at some point, when the NFL kept getting better and better players and bigger, I'm sure teams like my uncle said, we're not playing these guys. We got no business on the same field with them. I mean, I don't know you needed a dictum from the president or the governor. At some point, it becomes just common sense. We're not like those guys. And it's not like, I mean, you can play softball against a team that's 10 times better than you, and the worst that could happen is you get your ass kicked 20-0. I mean, you're not going to get hurt. I mean, they're not going to drive the ball through your head in the outfield. But football, at some point, when are the teams with this massive, you know, recruiting and massive payroll going to stop playing Mississippi State, for God's sake? Well, they're pretty good, but, you know.
Yeah, you just named an SEC team.
Yeah, but, I mean, at some point, you got to sit there and go, you guys got to play each other. Now, you can't be playing these other people. Just saying. I mean,
they just did that in the SEC starting next year.
What they did what?
The SEC was in, and this is one of the big problems everybody had with it. I love Notre Dame fans who know nothing about how conferences work.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, I agree.
I almost find it comical how you know that you just named Mississippi State as a swap team. That's how you guys are as bad as Yankee fans are in the baseball world. You know that?
Well, I was trying to name a team that didn't have the same kind of payroll.
You should have said Mississippi Valley University.
Okay.
Or there was one year, you know, the SEC, they only played 8 conference games a year. Everybody else played 9. And that ninth game was always homecoming against, you know, a second tier team. You know, the freaking Citadel would play South Carolina and lose 63-0 for homecoming.
Oh, good.
My school, when it was Memphis State, before I went there in the early 80s, when it were really, just really bad at football, even discussing dropping it, one year we had 6 road games and every single one was an SEC homecoming.
And you probably got, what, $200,000 a game or something like that?
I think it basically funded the program. I think, yeah. And we upset one of them. And now that Memphis has reached this point where, you know, they're always on the discussion around that 12, that final college football playoff spot that everybody says shouldn't even go to one of those conferences. But if you don't give something to one of those conferences, what the hell are they got to play for? You know,
Michigan, what year?
When a sport turns into on day, you know, there's this weird belief in baseball that on opening day, everybody's got, you know, some sort of a realistic shot of making the playoffs. You know, right now, I would say of the 130-something teams in college football, I don't know, 110 have already been eliminated from the playoffs.
Well, plus they're going to keep raising the amount of people in the playoffs.
It's because of the way that they pick the playoff teams. Even if you went 11-0, if there's 2 teams that go 11-0 that are the sloppy teams, only one of them is going to get in.
Well, that's right.
The way that it's set up right now, it's impossible just based on the schedule that you play for well over half of those college football teams to even get in their playoff. So what's the use in even going to a game or rooting for them or paying attention?
Well, that's starting to fall. I with you on that.
I'm paying less and less attention, and I used to be diehard about all these things, and I just care less and less and less.
Well, it's becoming another professional. I just wonder, and we'll bring Larissa in. Larissa, when does this start to run afoul of being a religious institution like Notre Dame or not for profit when this kind of money's flying around?
You aren't a not for profit.
I get the part where, you know, the Notre Dame, and I'll use them as an example, you know, the church is nonprofit by the Constitution, separation of church and state. I get the part maybe about the little school next to it How do you even make the attempt that the Notre Dame football program should be tax exempt?
I think anybody with a national TV, I know I'm speaking over Larissa, but I think anybody with a national TV contract is not a not-for-profit.
Well, then they're going to say, oh, no, they use all the money for whatever.
I actually, I think there's a lot of not-for-profits that perhaps should be taxed on some of their money. It's not that difficult to get not-for-profit status. When I started Stewart Investments back in 2005, it was an investment fund that invested in equities, but we raised money from alumni and students, and we managed money as a group of students, and we were able to establish ourselves as a 501c3 under the guise of education. So all of our profits from any trading activity were then not taxed.
So you were able to give out 100%, not whatever you made minus the taxes?
Correct.
Well, you did give it out, though, right?
No, we didn't give it out. So it was reinvested. We didn't really have a solid plan for how to divest or how to distribute funds, and we were able to get a not-for-profit status. We did put in our bylaws that if the organization dissolves, that the money would go to the university we were affiliated with, which is Illinois Institute of Technology. But again, it was, and this was over 20 years ago, but the paperwork to get this done and get this approved was fairly simple.
20 years ago, you were doing all this when you were 15?
Yeah, right.
What is the difference between what this was and a charitable trust where you have to give out a certain amount per year? Is it?
This isn't a trust. This is a not-for-profit organization.
Okay. And is that a corporation or what is it?
It's a 501c3.
Okay, so it's
just like a church, just like a school, and again, we had one audit, and I wasn't 15, but I was quite young, from the IRS, who questioned some of the things, because you have to fill out a paperwork every year to demonstrate that you are truly not-for-profit. But excluding that, I don't believe we were audited in over 20 years.
Is this this the same thing that people use for these political deals?
It could. I have no idea.
I think it is.
But my point to your question is, where does it stop becoming a not-for-profit, and when do taxes really need to start taking in? I think that there, to some extent, deeper thoughts need to be applied to what is a not-for-profit. And also, the government needs to think about how much manpower do they want to put behind it. So the organization wasn't generating enough, a whole lot of money to tax. So I don't know that it would have been worth the manpower to come after us. Even we weren't doing anything nefarious, but the point being, you know, it's a balance of how much money you're going to spend, how much you're going to go after people, and that kind of thing.
Well, it starts to encroach, sort of like a cockroach. I mean, how big do Indiana, Notre Dame, and Purdue have to get? When I say big, how far do they have to encroach in the professional area, which they're getting there pretty damn fast, when the Indianapolis Colts pay an amusement tax on the tickets and the other three don't?
Right.
I mean, to me, they're getting pretty close. I'm not saying they're there yet, but they're getting pretty close. I don't know about Purdue, but Indiana, after the last couple of years, and I mean, if you can pay a coach $10 million, there's a profit there someplace, right? Well, that's the most interesting part of having you on, Larissa, is I ask these questions that are kind of would make no sense to anybody, yet you make sense of them. And last week when you were on, we talked all week about the people you said couldn't define tariffs, but everybody's got an opinion. Or couldn't work through how they all work. And this week I'm going to say, what do people normally think profit is? When Russell, were you the one who told me the biggest... I don't know about the biggest, one of the biggest cash generators in the Chicago area is Northwestern University. And I don't, do they even pay a water bill, Russell? I don't think they do. Even that's comped, isn't it?
I don't remember telling you that.
I mean, somebody did. I don't know if it's true. I mean, but they...
Could it be the hospital?
Yeah, it's Northwest, well, the hospital. I mean, they own how many square blocks of real estate in Chicago? That if other people were there, I mean, you know, look at State Street, which isn't doing so hot, but there's four universities here. Buildings that used to be Goldblatt, Sears, and places that paid taxes, now they don't. I mean, but it's not like there's not any money there. Duh.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where you go with this. That's why Larissa always has an insight in these kinds of things. I mean, we're starting to get, you know, dramatic amounts of money in places where, you know, as the healthcare system is now what? It's 20-some percent of the economy. By the way, I'm gonna definitely ask Russell at some point here, what is with this juxtaposition in the market where one day you jam all the AI stocks down like a gazillion percent and everybody goes and buys Sherwin-Williams in healthcare? Where's the Paris trade there, Russell? What the hell?
Between...
Well, I mean, you sell in one place, but you can't ever... Your money can't just leave. It's got to go somewhere else, and you buy something... Well, last week, the AI stocks were down like 3%, and the transportation area was up 3%. Man, what investor sells Micron and buys, you know, Chessie Systems, for God's sake? But obviously, people are doing it.
Well, I don't think it's that direct swap, but it could be just, you know... I just can't fathom that a technology investor is switching like that.
I can't fathom it. Anyway, go back to my profit thing, Larissa. When you start talking about taxes and everything, and income, and these governments are all broke, at what point do you say, wait a minute, how does every hospital be, you know, when that's where 20% of the GNP is, how in God's name can they all be non-profit?
Well, and I think it's interesting, if you were to talk to most people, when they think about profits and taxing those organizations for their profits, I think they would be very pro-taxation so that those organizations could, you know, pay their, air quote, fair share. But I think if you were to press on those people and explain to them where the money's really going, how this really impacts them as an individual, I think people would be a lot more gun-shy.
Well, you like to think that Northwestern puts it all back into care.
Exactly. And if you were to explain how, if Northwestern were to all of a sudden start having to eat those taxation or eat that money from taxation, I think people would change their tune quite a bit because that would have a negative impact on what they're spending.
Well, I think that you could probably make a delineation from... Whatever you want to call it, income taxes versus other taxes. I mean, clearly they get police help, they get fire help, they get all those kinds of things. And if they don't pay anything on that, I mean, instead of paying the guy who runs the place how many million dollars you pay him, I guess you could cut him back a hair and pay for the police protection, don't you think? I mean, it's comes a question of you know, common sense at some point here, which we don't seem to have. In my opinion, anyway. But when you look at all these governments that are broke, I mean, you need to look at stuff like this, right? I mean, who pays what where? Anyway, so what's the hot topic in your guys' classes? What going forward here? We have how many million problems in the world? We were talking about money laundering earlier in the show and how this whole Epstein thing, and just that's just a part of it. And, well, the thing that got us on this thing, have you guys, I'm not going to go into too much detail, have you read any of this diary stuff that's come out on Fauci the last couple of days?
Not yet. I know he's going in front of Congress today, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm saying, I know you don't drink, but you might need a gummy or something before you read it. It's that bad.
It's kind of funny. My wife, you know, who was in drug research, she worked with him when she was a nursing student.
Wow.
and just thought he was the end all be. He was going to solve all of our damn problems when he started popping up around the COVID thing. But you got to like when you're brought in to solve a problem that you were part of the part of the creating of the problem.
Well, it's one of those things where, Larissa, if you haven't figured it out yet, every time I get a question and I start researching the answer, I end up with like 20 more questions, which I guess anybody who's ever done research runs into the same thing, right? But he, when he started talking about these places that were funded in, what, five or six now are in Ukraine that were these gain-of-function and essentially bio research labs, and one of them was in Wuhan, but there were a bunch in Ukraine. And there was an executive order from Obama and other kinds of things as to, you're not supposed to do this. The Department of Defense said, we don't want to do it. Yet somehow or another, Fauci and group engineered somebody's money through North Carolina and other places to get to these places, which brings up the topic I was discussing with Kevin. If you took the whole history of chemical and biological weaponry, was any of it ever passed by Congress, or was it all just CIA money that was somehow appropriated for these things? Did anybody ever know what was going on? Was there ever any kind of supervision? I mean, it's kind of scary, but you wonder, has it always been like that? Which doesn't absolve anybody. But then it appears that even stuff like the masks. In his diary, he says they knew masks weren't going to help anything, and yet they demanded everybody wear them anyway. And stuff like that is really creepy, isn't it?
Well, the masks weren't going to work. The vaccine, it didn't mean you weren't going to get it. It just meant that it wasn't going to make you as sick. You know, the whole... But I don't think a lot of people were... I don't know if it was presented to the average person like that. You know, because if I don't take the... there was a thing where if you don't take the shot, then you might kill your grandfather. Well, that wasn't true at all.
Right. Well, that's right.
That's not how it worked.
Well, he...
You know? And honestly, the better thing probably would have been to let the freaking thing just run its course.
Well, it starts with him talking about... You guys remember this. That the... they spent like what, a month saying it came out of this fish market. Evidently, in his diary, he knew the whole time that it didn't come from the fish market.
Well, that's because he was involved in the funding of the place it came out of.
I wonder what
we had been helping, and you know, at the time we were helping fund gain of function research in China on viruses like that, and the Chinese government. I personally think the Chinese government was facing a demographic situation, so they created this thing to knock off their old people, and it escaped.
Well,
I know that sounds a bit far. That's honestly what I think they were trying to do.
What's their?
Because they've got such a demographic bomb. You know, everybody gets to retire at 60 there, and 2/3 of their people are going to be over 60 in the next couple of decades.
Larissa, you never heard this story, but I don't think you did, but one of the guys here who shares office with an attorney, he takes an Uber every morning, right? And when all this stuff is happening, he gets an Uber driver that's from Wuhan, and evidently he's on the phone with somebody, and he says, yeah, they claim that there's 35,000 deaths in China, and the guy goes, as soon as he's off the phone, he goes, who are you kidding? He goes, what do you mean? He goes, if there's 35,000 deaths in China, you would not have heard about it. My family's from Wuhan. They've got crematoriums going 24/7. They won't let anybody... They locked everybody's doors, and if you're dead, they shove the body out the back door. He goes, what was the number, Russell, that was like 5 million or some huge number of cell phones that were all of a sudden... The numbers were blank?
Yeah. It was a bunch of cell phones just suddenly stopped being used over
there. Yeah. And, I mean, the whole thing was kind of a lie... But evidently, it gets deeper than that. That there were treatments that they knew worked, and they were banned. Same thing with it. He did the same thing with AIDS. There was a drug that actually helped people with AIDS, but he wouldn't let they banned it. I mean, you're talking, you know, millions of people.
He was supposed to be the guy that cured AIDS when they rolled him out and said he's going to fix this COVID situation.
Well, he.
I just remember that was, you know, why he was such a rock star when my wife was, a nursing student in Boston. He was there doing stuff.
there was a thing with...
It was from the AIDS thing, apparently. He was... But, you know, in reality...
Larissa,
in reality, he's not as great as everybody thinks.
Well, Larissa, you might be too young for this, but when AIDS first came out, some people, and won't, Reagan was the president, and he let people say this without shutting them up. I don't think he ever felt this way. There were some people on the religious right, I mean the serious right, that thought this was God's revenge against gay people. To the point where it actually, I'm going to say, slowed down the research a little bit. And Time Magazine, you know, we were living on the South Side. I was living with Dr. J in his big house in Beverly. It was a riot. We always got, because, you know, it's long before the internet, we always got U.S. News Report, World Report, and we switched back and forth between Time and Newsweek. And just maybe because of a liberal bias or something, which Time I don't think ever really was, but they, just to combat this idea that only gay people were dying from it, so don't worry about it, they published the Time Magazine 1 week. In the middle of it was like 30 pages of the faces of AIDS. And they had pictures and little bios of all the people that were dying from it. And most of the people were dying from it were getting blood transfusions before you could test whether the blood had AIDS in it. And all these people, especially from California, that own, you know, wineries and everything, are all dying. They weren't gay. You know who died from that, had a horrible death from it, was Amanda Blake, Kitty on Gunsmoke. Died of AIDS after a transfusion. Anyway, enough of that. Economy-wise, we've got the market doing this. We got the chairman of the Fed talking today. What's he going to say, guys? Is it going to affect anything? Larissa, what's your current inflation monitor that you keep track of? Where's that going? I have a guy here who works in the building. I think you might have met him, Russell. But he's a guy that does a lot of odd jobs for people and makes money, you know, remodeling houses and stuff. And all of a sudden, he's got a transmission problem in his truck, and he's like, this is like, it's going to be like 15 weekends pay to fix my transmission, for God's sake. I mean, is that what you're, when you talk about how it's hurting families, is that what you're talking about, Larissa, that somehow the matchup between an hourly wage being less than lunch is starting to affect people?
Well, it's funny you should say that. So I'm starting to work with my eldest about what money is and the value of money. We went out back to school shopping yesterday, and I think I spent over $200 on just stuff that they need for school. And my eldest said, well, that's not too bad. You've got money, no big deal. And I started laughing, and I said, well, let's talk about this a little bit more. I said, they're going to get $10 a week. But I'm going to make them pay taxes so that they only really get $7 of disposable income. And I said, well, how long would it really take for you to, and how long would it take for you to actually pay this bill? And the look on his face of like, oh. I said, yeah. So we're starting to really think about these things. And I think a lot of people are in that situation of thinking, okay, now it's credit card debt is where it is, and they need to start to pull back on some of their spending. And we have spoken many times on this program about how restaurants and things like that are, they might have people in the door, but they're not really seeing, the per spending that they used to spend. For example, I know I've cut back on the kids no longer get beverages. I mean, they get water at restaurants, which I also think is good for their teeth, and will always help with toothaches. But we're in a situation where people are looking for ways to pull back, and as we've spoken many times on this program, I think that's not necessarily being reflected as well in the aggregate numbers, because if the amount of money that we're spending at the restaurant really doesn't change because of the price that products have gone up, we're in a situation where on the surface it looks like everything's the same. But as we've discussed many times in the past, it really isn't.
If you can, either one of you, because this is kind of the question, I guess. Well, Carl's been ranting and raving about the interest rates moving, and you know, is the market ever going to show up? But let's leave that topic for next week. But we seem to have, and you know, I guess I'll be accusatory here. We have what you see happening, which really means that for a long period of time, and we could debate the time, prices have snuck up a little more per year than people's general income. And whether it's 2 years, 5 years, 20 years, whatever, I happen to think it's at least since 2007, maybe to 2000, but that's just me. Now, and then we have somebody like you who studies this stuff, and by the way, has a brain cell working and some eyes working. You say, wait a minute, back to school is costing me 10% more than last year, and by the way, I'm making 5% more, hopefully, at least that. This is a problem year after year, and but then you know, you get a government that comes out and says, wait a minute, inflation's 2.5%, don't worry about it. Well, okay, but after a long period of time, you know, you can start filling up, you know, somebody's room with water. When it gets to your neck, you start to notice it, right? What's the break point in what happens? I mean, is it an election loss? Is it because it's kind of a whatever party you like. Both parties have been doing it. I mean, I don't know that I would say one lies more than the other, although it seems like this group likes to lie, but maybe it's just because I'm listening day by day. It's been going on for a while. What is the break point? I mean, it's not bayonets and guns, I hope. Is it the ballot box when both sides seem to be in it together? I mean, where does the Larissa of the world get heard to the point where somebody does something about it? Are we anywhere near there? Or is everybody just going to bitch at each other constantly and argue with family members and everything else, when in fact, you know, that the problem's been there for a while? Where do we go with this, I guess, is my question. Well, I mean, I don't know, and I see other kind of weird. We've had, you guys, I think you've been in Indiana, but we've had some nasty storms out here in the last whatever. Audrey was talking to her fence guy. She had a fence put in. The guy did a nice job. Well, one tree went down next door. This is this 5 week ago storm, and the dude fence went down where they propped it back up, and the guy's going to come out and fix it. Well, it took him a month to get out there. Nice guy. I think he's a Hispanic dude. He's been here 25 years. I think he's a citizen. And he goes, I can't get anybody to work for me. Like, everybody's afraid. And he said, I'm paying good money. It's not like anybody is rolling out of Inglewood or rolling out of a suburban house to come work here. Nobody wants this kind of work. So I can't get anybody. And get a load of this. The day after that storm where Audrey's fence went down, guess how many calls the guy got for repairs on fences? This is one company. 1,000. Had 1,000 calls in one day. It's taken him 4 or 5 weeks. He goes, I put applications out. I can't hire a soul. So the labor stuff, the remodeling stuff, kind of tied with, can't wait to kick everybody out of here. In addition to, that's the kind of inflation you don't even know is there until you try and get somebody to do something.
Sure.
I'm not saying they're totally tied together, but it's you know, it's a, I mean, this week, we want to kick out, what, 400,000 Somalis, or 300,000, whatever the hell it is. Well, evidently, the Somalis that are here, from what I read, are really involved in a lot of home care. Who the hell is going to take care of people's old people? You kick everybody out. I mean, it's all part of this, like, inflation thing that you're always, because whenever you're on, you lead me to an area that I never even thought of. So that's what you do.
You realize the Somali home care companies are what all the fraud is about in Minnesota, right?
I know they're part of it. Yeah, I mean, I don't know the details.
No. They're, I mean, it's basically, you know, preschool learning centers that nobody goes to, and a lot of fraudulent home care where they say that they're taking care of people that just don't even exist.
All right. Well, the,
so I think we're going to be okay kicking 400 Somalis out of the United
400,000
out of the United States. Well, I don't think it's going to have any inflationary impact, and if anything, it's just going to reduce the amount of fraud that we've been dealing with from immigrants.
Well, that's what this.
No, there's nothing positive.
Okay, that's
about,
what.
That's about what, people from Somalia that have come to the United States. They haven't built crap. All they've done is show up and try to scam us. And don't cite that group as somebody that has helped our country in any way, shape, or form.
All right, I'm going to have to push back, because we listen to this administration, which never tells the truth ever, in my opinion. Okay, once in a while by accident. Now, they're going to come out and say there's fraud in some of the Somali areas, which I believe them. There probably
I'm
is.
I'm only citing
all right.
that Nick Shirley got. I'm not. It has nothing to do with what the United States government has said.
Okay, what I'm saying
is it's actual convictions that you've seen. This is actual real news.
Okay, what
that is, you know. I actually hate being on the program with you when you start saying this administration does nothing but lie. So I'm gonna call it a.
Well, I mean, my point is when I say lie, which maybe I shouldn't use that term, when I say lie, if I were to find 15 traitors who were bad, if I were to find 15 professors that were bad, I would never apply that to you or me. Yet we seem to have this thing where if we find, say, it's 50,000 out of 400,000. Somalis that are crooked, which I think is probably a lot, somehow or another we were asked to apply it to everybody. And I don't like to generalize. I won't generalize for me or you or them. I can't believe they're all crooks. I mean, are they really? I mean, I it would be hard for me to believe that is all I'm saying. I mean, we're expected to jump to the conclusion that everybody is a crook. And we can't make that jump. If they're going to find people that are crooked, put them in jail, for God's sake. Deport them. Do something with them. I'm with you on this 100%, Russell. But the idea that everybody is involved, I mean, I know that a lot of home care here in Chicago, and who knows, they're probably all citizens, but a lot of people from the Philippines, that's what they do. And if I were to find a crooked home care center in Chicago that had 15 Filipino people that were, I just don't want to extend it to everybody. I mean, That's all I'm barking back at is what they're expecting. I don't think they're lying about Somalis being crooked in Minnesota. I mean, that's obviously happening, right? That's kind of where I'm at on this. So it's the extension that I have a problem with. It's not the particular people they found that were wrong. Does that help you? Are you here? Lewis, are you here?
I'm here.
Anyway. I just, that's where I'm at. I hope Russell's not too mad at me. But it's the extension that all of a sudden everybody's like that. I mean, there's people in my industry that aren't legit, but I hope that people won't apply that to me. Just saying. So there. So
yes,
what?
I don't know if that's true. I think everybody in the financial markets is legit.
No, there's been a few. Who's the guy that Madoff? He wasn't all that legit. There's been a few. There's been some guys. But we're not all Madoff, I hope. You know,
we're not all what?
Bernie Madoff.
No.
But you know what, Larissa? The funny part about that guy, talk about a history. When I was on the board, he invented payment for order flow. I don't know if you knew that or not. He was a problem long before he was any of this stuff with this place came out, and the industry just didn't know how to deal with him, and he just got worse and worse and worse till he did this other stuff. It wasn't like this was his first rodeo, and it's kind of the same stuff we talk about on the show a lot with Fauci and everybody else. It's not like these people don't have a history. They do, and they just are allowed to kind of keep going, and all of a sudden, like, whoa. He bought, the CBOE bought the Cincinnati Stock Exchange, okay? But there was a little-known rule that if an exchange bought another exchange, they could only vote one seat. So the CBOE owned, I'm going to say, 300 seats. They got one vote. Madoff owned five seats, and he got five votes. So the CBOE really was powerless to even deal with the guy. Can you imagine that? And he started this payment for order flow thing, where if he went to the Cincinnati, he made good the New York market. And at the time, 36% of the trades were traded between the markets. So he would charge, he would give everybody a penny a share to trade with him. And he had something where he could actually, if an IBM's offered a 100 and a quarter in New York, he could actually take the 100 and a quarter offer in New York. So you'd trade with him at a quarter, he'd wait for a few seconds, and if nobody came in to sell it at an eighth, he'd just take the offer in New York. So he essentially, if you do the math, if the markets are, say, a quarter wide or an eighth wide, and 36% of them are between the market, the math is to being able to do it on the offer or the bid ahead of somebody else, probably worth 5 to 6 cents a share, and he was paying people 1 cent a share. So he did very, very well, and somehow until that all got, now the markets went narrower and now they're a penny wide and so forth. And that's when he started this other stuff. But it wasn't like he wasn't a bad guy the whole way. And when you look at what's going on with the Fauci situation, there were so many thoughts and murmurs about how he handled the AIDS situation. To allow him to become the god in the COVID situation is like, God, how could you do that? And his diary is like putting all that stuff out. And the guy actually wrote it down. Can you imagine that?
I'm pretty surprised that he did.
Yeah. And he wrote, it was in government computers. It wasn't like in a diary in his bedroom. How do you... Anyway. So when are you teaching and what are you starting?
In a couple of weeks, on August 24th, I'm teaching a lot of investments. And I'm teaching it.
And we say investments, what kind? You dig into stock options and futures or just...
We cover it all.
Really? How many people...
theoretical framework, and we finish with derivatives.
How many people have an interest in... obviously, Purdue's in an agricultural state. When we first started the business here, we did a real lot of... trade and people were really interested in corn and soybeans and wheat. Now, boy, there's very little interest in that. The people who trade through us actually now are farmers. I mean, they're doing it because they have to. But are people interested in the ag markets when you bring that up in class, or do they just want to get to the next subject?
They want to get to the next subject. So I'm right now working with primarily undergraduate students. I had spoken to, there's an ag econ department, and they are much more interested in the futures and in that type of material.
You're going to bring in, does anybody want, do you ever bring people up like Russell did with his group to go through the Board of Trade and stuff? It's not that far.
The business school does that.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You guys can't ever pile on the bus?
I'm not entirely sure how they transport all the students. Historically, for particularly the undergrads, they focus a little bit more on investment banking, which I thought was interesting. So they do trips up to Chicago to speak to investment banks, which is very different than trading in the derivatives market, as you know.
When they say investment banking, they're talking about financing new firms and those kinds of things?
Yes.
Do you go down that road at all?
I have not, personally. And it's funny, I was reflecting on this. It's just because I've been on more of the trading side of things, the investment banking side, you have to make so many assumptions, and it's a lot less technical and a lot more deeper understanding. And so it's a very different type of work.
Yeah, it's because it's pretty complicated. I mean, I wonder how much I haven't taken an investment banking class in so long. I wonder how those guys cover stuff like you know, these they call the people who get involved in the startup firms and stuff. What do they call those things?
The IPOs.
Well, no, way before IPOs, the people that
the angel investors.
Yeah, the angel investors. And, well, I don't know much about that. Do you? We should talk about that someday.
I've worked with IIT Illinois Institute of Technology. They have an incubator space, and they worked with 1829 to really help promote some of these small businesses. And part of there was an entrepreneur center that was looking to connect angels with some of these new startup businesses. So I have a little bit of experience with it, but not much.
Seems like kind of a fascinating area, but hey, we're a little over time. S&P futures down 2, NASDAQ futures down 15. What do you think the Fed's going to do today? Nothing?
I have no idea. I'm excited to see.
Yeah, it's interesting to see. Anyway, you take care of yourself. Always good. Hopefully Russell's not too mad at me. We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks.